Case for the day is Patel v. Holder, number 093417, and we'll hear from Mr. Sanders. Good afternoon,
Mr. Sanders. Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon. I have a few legal bars to get over to win my case today. The first one that they allege is that you don't have any jurisdiction, so we might as well just call the whole thing off and go home. First of all, they say we didn't raise any kind of due process or argument earlier, so we're prohibited from doing it now. But if you read my brief to the BIA, the second issue had to do with due process and the legal standard that the judge must follow in determining whether we satisfy the exceptions to the one-year bar on filing the asylum.
How do we have jurisdiction, though, to review that? I thought we decided in Zaidi against Ashcroft that we don't have jurisdiction to determine the application of exceptions to that one-year limit.
But you do if there is a question of due process or law.
And how is there a question of due process in the petitioner's failure to seek asylum within the first year after he arrived in the country?
By coming under the exception of exceptional circumstance, he is able to file an asylum late. The question is, did he meet the legal standard, and did the judge use the correct legal standard in turning him down and therefore not giving him the due process that he's entitled to? And we would look at those questions.
Sounds, Mr. Sanders, like you're saying that you can cast any decision in applying the exceptions to the time limit as a failure to comply with due process of law. Hence, any decision would be reviewable by the courts.
No, it must have some substance to the argument. And
how was he denied due process by not allowing him to file a late petition for asylum?
By virtue of the process that the judge went through in applying the law,
the application of the law is a denial of due process.
If you improperly
error of law is it
improperly yeah, if you make an error of law, then your process is tainted and it's not due process.
And in litigation involving state law, people are often trying to argue that an error of state law amounts to a denial of due process under the federal Constitution. And this court and every other court for more than a generation has been saying, no, that's an error of state law is not a denial of due process. Why would an error of federal immigration law amount to a denial of due process?
The legal standard must be met. And if it's not met, then the process is tainted. Now, Illinois law, I'm not sure what you're talking about under the Illinois law, but there was ample evidence provided that
evidence
the judge disregarded and misapplied.
Evidence of exceptional circumstances, something that...
Yes, Your Honor.
What?
Has to do with his claim that looking at the totality of circumstances, that he presented substantial evidence about his diabetes and his other infirmities that got in his way of understanding and knowing that he had the right and being able to exercise it. This gentleman had a second grade education.
You're talking about when he got here, right?
Pardon?
You're talking when he got here.
Yes.
Right. And so he's just found all these things out basically when they found him.
Right. He had no idea. He was working in a donut factory as a baker, and didn't have contact with the public. He didn't speak English to any degree. He was working for someone who spoke Gujarati, and this is in the record. And he felt, and no one else helped him, and he testified he was also very uncomfortable in the United States for a number of years when he first came here. And so he's a sort of a sequestered individual that doesn't speak the language and doesn't understand the customs. He's had a problem medically with respect to his diabetes. He testified he had been in the hospital for 7 days and then was put on medicine, and he took other medicine. And he had been so sick that at one point he lost a lot of his belongings because his landlord threw him out and didn't handle the circumstances. To me, that indicates that he was having a lot of problems dealing socially and taking care of himself, accentuated by the diabetes and the general posture that he was working with and living in. And he put this in as evidence, whereas the judge said there was no evidence that he had any kind of extraordinary circumstance. Whereas there, I think everything that I described, looking at it in the totality, indicates that, yes, he had a lot of problems, given his disabilities of education, lack of education, and medical condition. The second aspect of this case is the asylum, the basis of the asylum itself. The legal standard has to be looked at again to see if the evidence presented allowed the judge to say, oh, nothing was given and nothing should be counted, primarily with respect to credibility. The judge said his Patel's testimony was not credible. And based on that, put a larger burden on him than would otherwise be the case. If the finding of not having credibility is found in reverse, then his testimony was to be considered as presumably correct, unless rebutted, as opposed to once there's credibility found against him, he has a higher burden of proving his credibility against the arguments that the judges submit. And we would submit that the judge improperly put in the finding of credibility. We have to look at here again the totality of the circumstances starting from the beginning. The circumstance of Mr. Patel in India was that he was in this small town, lacking education and just doing farming. He was a member involved with people of the BJ party, BJP, who were pretty much in control. And the judge himself indicated that the BJP were involved in disputes between the Muslims and the Hindus going back to the 1980s, and that the situation that Mr. Patel was in was not just simply where someone from the BJP walked up to him and said, hey, you want to go to a demonstration we're having? And Patel says no. This preparation had to be going on for a considerable period of time and was ongoing from the 1980s and 1990s. And I think the judge, while he stated that in the beginning, lost track of it when it came time to see, well, why did something happen to Mr. Patel's wife and children well before this actual, quote, demonstration occurred? The demonstration was not simply a demonstration. It was an attack on a mosque which was demolished. It wasn't just people carrying signs out in front of the mosque. and people were killed, and there was ongoing investigations for years. There was a riot there, and this didn't occur overnight. They planned and had it done, had it set up, and in the preparation, they were asking all kinds of people, would he do it? And in a small town, if someone refuses the boss, they set a principle, and other people will refuse. So there was great pressure put on him to agree.
Didn't that happen after his wife and child died?
Right. Because at that point, they were recruiting. And just like in a Chicago gang, you know, if they can't get a guy to join, it means other people won't, recruits won't join. So the same circumstance here.
Mr. Sanders, your time has expired, but we'll, if you want to take any extra time for rebuttal, we'll give you an extra minute. I think we may have had a little confusion here on timing, okay?
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Sanders. For the government, Ms. Lee.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Sana Lee representing the Attorney General. Your Honors, I just wanted to just briefly go over the facts of this case. The petitioner in this case claimed that his wife and child were killed in India in 1992 by members of his own political party, the BJP party, because he did not join the march on the mosque. And that march, he said, took place in December 1992. He continued living in India for over 5 years after his wife and child were allegedly killed, and he continued to support the BJP party throughout that whole 5 years. And for some reason, he said he left because he was scared of the BJP party. So he left in 1998 and came to the United States, began working for a Dunkin' Donuts for many years. And then over 8 years later, in 2007, after the Department of Homeland Security charged him with removability, only then did he file his applications for asylum and withholding of removal. And, of course, the judge denied the application, the asylum one, because it was filed after the one-year deadline, and he failed to establish any exceptions. And he also denied the withholding application because he was not credible. As to the asylum application, as Judge Hamilton said earlier, the court does not have jurisdiction over the denial of the asylum application because it's decided in Zaida that you don't have jurisdiction over that or the agency's determinations on exceptions to the deadline. Mr. Patel did not raise a due process issue below regarding that. He made a few claims about the IJ, the immigration judge, failing to articulate reasons and things like that, but he did not raise those to the board, so those he failed to exhaust. The only thing he did raise, he did raise an issue to this court about the board not stating its reasons for that denial, and the board did actually state a reason. And otherwise, Mr. Patel failed to raise any sort of error of law or constitutional claim regarding the asylum application. And also under Viracocha, as Judge Hamilton stated earlier, an error of law is not a question of law.
What case are you citing there?
Viracocha.
I'm new here.
Okay. That was also...
Sanders also knows.
That was also a case involving a one-year asylum application, but that was concerning whether an error of law can be considered a question of law.
Do you have a cite for that?
I think I have it in my brief.
You wouldn't mind? If it's in your brief? Or...
site is 518 F3rd 511.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
And so as far as the asylum application goes, as we argued in the brief, the court does not have jurisdiction to review that denial. And moving on to the petitioner's request for withholding, the record here does not compel the conclusion that he established that he testified credibly about what happened in India. And that is the standard of review here.
Ms. Lee, can I ask you a question? I'm still going to beg indulgence because I'm relatively new. I understand your argument that we don't have jurisdiction to consider denial of asylum. Let's suppose there were a compelling case for withholding of removal. And in that situation, the court said, no, we think we've got to grant this petition remand for granting of withholding of removal. What status would that leave somebody in if they don't get asylum, but they do get withholding of removal? Aren't they in kind of a limbo at that point?
As far as I know, withholding of removal does not lead to permanent resident status. So
they just sort of stay here illegally, but without an order to remove them.
They can probably be removed to a country other than
Okay.
that they fear returning to.
Okay. Somebody else will accept them.
Right.
Okay. But it's a weird kind of status.
It doesn't have as many benefits as asylum.
Okay.
It's usually harder to get than asylum also.
Right, and the standard is higher. Mm-hmm. It's a clear probability of persecution as opposed to a well-founded fear of persecution for asylum. And here, as I was saying, the record does not compel the conclusion that the petitioner testified credibly. Under the Real ID Act, which applies to this case, an adverse credibility determination may be based on falsehoods without regard to whether they go to the heart of the claim. And here, there was a major inconsistency, which did go to the heart of the claim, even though that's not required for an adverse credibility determination here. And that was that the petitioner claims that his wife and daughter were killed by BJP members in December of 1992, after he joined the party, and after he refused to march with them. But he submitted death certificates that stated that his wife and daughter were killed on January 6, 1992. So about 12 months earlier than the march and when he refused to march with them. And he did not really give a satisfactory explanation of why he testified that they were killed in December of 1992 when the death certificates said otherwise. He tried to explain that his wife died before he joined the party, but that still doesn't explain why they were killed in January and the march took place in December, and that was the whole reason that the party supposedly wanted to kill him. The petitioner also gave different stories about the actions that he took after his wife and child were killed. First, he said he did not see the bodies because if he went to go see them, then the police would kill him. But then later he said he went to see them and then the BJP members pushed him and then he ran away. And then furthermore, there's a major implausible aspect of his testimony in that he said that he lived in Ahmedabad, a different city, because, you know, he ran away to the city because he was scared. He lived there for 5 years, but yet he continued to support the party that killed his wife and child. And this, you know, really doesn't make sense. He didn't really give any explanation for why he would continue to support a party that killed his family members. And then as far as the corroborating evidence goes, the petitioner did not submit sufficient evidence to support his claim. The only documents that related personally to him were the death certificates, and those obviously undermined his claim rather than supported the claim. And he submitted some country conditions evidence, some country reports and things like that. But he did not submit a marriage certificate, a birth certificate for his daughter, did not submit any affidavits from anyone who knew about his case. He still has family members in India who presumably would know what happened to him. He did not submit anything by them. And just to sum up here, the record does not compel the conclusion that the petitioner was credible, and so the court should deny the petition in part. And the court should also dismiss the petition in part because it lacks jurisdiction to review the denial of his asylum application.
Thank you, Ms. Lee.
Thank you.
A moment of rebuttal, Mr. Sanders.
Mr. Patel did not say that his wife died in December. He was asked, was your wife killed because of communal violence? And he said, yes, she was killed because of all of this goings-on with communal violence. He said because of, not at or by, as they are alleging that he testified that she died in December. If you look at the record, you'll see the difference in the wording. And this illustrates the errors that the judge picked up in a number of cases. He brought the certificates of the death. He testified about them. He said his wife was cremated. He said he had received threats while he was in Ahmedabad that from family members saying that people were still looking for him during the time that he was in Ahmedabad. It helped him send up to go to the United States. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Sanders. The case will be taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess until next Tuesday. Thank you all.